The U.S. Supreme Court handed down historic rulings last week in cases of federal health care subsidies and same-sex marriage, but the decision that might have surprised legal observers the most had to do with fair housing. The court said that housing discrimination doesn't have to be intentional to be illegal. The case had to do with protections under the Federal Fair Housing Act of 1968. It outlawed housing discrimination based on race. At issue was whether the plaintiffs had to prove that housing policies in the state of Texas were intentionally racist or merely that they had the effect of promoting segregation. And the legal term for that is disparate impact. The justices ruled on the side of community housing groups that showed the policies amounted to de facto segregation. Today we'll hear what that ruling means for North Carolina and whether the disparate impact argument could be applied in other cases like voting rights and redistricting. Joining me now to talk about fair housing and other disparate impact claims is Elizabeth Haddix. She's a law professor at UNC Chapel Hill and a member of UNC's Center for Civil Rights. Elizabeth, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
It's nice to be here.
Also with us, Guy Charles, a professor of law at Duke University. Welcome back, Guy.
Thank you.
Let me start with you and explain the difference between proving intent and proving disparate impact. What does that term mean? Where does it come from?
Sure. So if you think of intent as the desire to discriminate and actually doing so. So if I take something away from you intentionally, right? So this is what we're thinking about, whether the government is engaging in discrimination on purpose because of somebody's race versus thinking about the effects of a particular rule. So for example, basketball has an effect on short people. The rim is 10 feet tall. The rules of basketball disproportionately benefit tall people as against short people. So we're thinking about the effects of a particular rule on particular groups, especially when those groups are differentially located, tall people versus short people. And so the question in this particular case is whether one can show discrimination by showing the effects of particular rules or policies on racial minorities, as opposed to the intentional discrimination by the state.
And how did this case work? Elizabeth, it goes back to what we're citing is a Fair Housing Act that was passed in 1968. Does that language have to be in the legislation, or what are the justices looking for in deciding this question over impact versus intent?
Well, and I have to correct you, Frank, I'm not actually a law professor. I am teaching a housing course next spring, but I'm not a full professor. I'm an attorney with the Center for Civil Rights. The justices were looking first for the plain language of this statute to see that's generally where the judges need to go, is to look at the plain language of the law and determine whether that plain language tells what the law is. If it's not in the plain language, then there's statutory construction and there's some sort of effort to figure out what the congressional intent was. This decision is interesting because it really is, the Justice Kennedy's opinion makes clear that the language in the statute indicates that it is that a disparate impact method of proof is appropriate under the Federal Fair Housing Act. But there's also discussion about the central purpose of the Fair Housing Act, which is to end slums, to end segregated communities. So.
Well, it's interesting to see how this is applied, Guy, because the same question came up in the voting rights decision, and their disparate impact was dismissed by the majority.
No, the Voting Rights Act contains a disparate impact provision, and so that's permissible and possible. Now, one interesting caveat is that the court hasn't fully ruled that disparate impact in voting rights is constitutional, but the Voting Rights Act does contain a disparate impact provision, and disparate impact, and this is why one of the reasons why this particular ruling in this case is so important, disparate impact is critical to a number of civil rights statutes, including the Voting Rights Act, employment discrimination, age discrimination. So a core number of civil rights statutes. This is one of the primary way of establishing discrimination across a number of different types of domains, including the Voting Rights Act.
So how the justices have come to their decision, because the voting rights decision last year, in a sense, went the other way.
Right. So what's interesting here is that this is why the most conservative justices on the court objected and dissented in this case. The worry is that you are entrenching race-based thinking by promoting disparate impact as a way of proving racial discrimination. And in the voting rights context, the court showed some hostility to race-based thinking and the idea that we need to carve out people on the basis of their race or their racial identity, or that race plays a significant role in voting, or racial discrimination is a problem in voting. So this is why many people were thinking, especially voting rights activists or civil rights activists, were thinking the court might have gone the other way here, right, because the court is hostile to entrenchment or thinking about racial discrimination across domains, including voting.
And in this case, apparently, at least Justice Kennedy felt that there's something different about where we are today in voting than where we are today in housing.
Well, certainly the first part of Justice Kennedy's opinion could have been written by any one of the liberals on the court, where he talks about that racial discrimination is still a problem in housing, where he links racial discrimination by the government to present inequality. And it's something that the court was not willing to do in the voting rights context.
All right, we're going to take a break now and come back and continue our conversation with Guy Charles, a law professor at Duke, and Elizabeth Haddix, who is with the UNC Center for Civil Rights. We'll continue our conversation about the fair housing ruling. We'll do that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about fair housing in North Carolina after last week's Supreme Court decision in a Texas fair housing case. Court said housing discrimination doesn't have to be intentional to be illegal under the Fair Housing Act. Plaintiffs only have to prove disparate impact, or simply that housing policies led to negative impacts on minority communities. Elizabeth Haddix is with me. She's an attorney, and she's at the UNC Center for Civil Rights. Guy Charles is here, a law professor at Duke University. So how in the state of North Carolina, for instance, how are fair housing, if I bring a complaint, if I say that this has happened in my community, who brings the complaint and where do I take it, Elizabeth?
Well, if you're a person or a community that's been injured by a racially discriminatory housing practice, then you can bring a complaint in state court or federal court under the Federal Fair Housing Act. You can bring it under our State Fair Housing Act, as long as the legislature doesn't eliminate it, as in the Senate's budget proposal. And or you can go to an administrative agency, the Human Relations Commission, and file an administrative complaint with the federal government or with our Human Relations Commission under the Federal Fair Housing Act.
And typically, how has that been handled in North Carolina?
Well, there is a surprisingly low number of complaints, cases under the State Fair Housing Act. In fact, one important one was one that the Center for Civil Rights brought on behalf of a historical African American community in Brunswick County, North Carolina, called Royal Oak. And that was a case, an environmental racism case, where this historical African American community was resisting the expansion of an existing landfill in their community, which was already hosting most of the county's end use facilities and operations. So the Royal Oak concerned citizens brought a complaint, which we helped them with, directly in Superior Court in Brunswick County, and one of the Superior Court rulings was that the State Fair Housing Act allows, just like the Federal Fair Housing Act, for a direct right of action in court, as well as an administrative complaint. So either route is permissible.
You talked about the Senate budget that would actually repeal the State Fair Housing Act, right? What effect would that have in North Carolina if that were repealed?
Well, I mean, it's an alarming move because under the State Fair Housing Act, communities have the ability to go into state court in their community. An important thing for communities that are sort of carrying the burden of these of discrimination, whether it be intentional or in effect. is that they don't, they're not heard, right? They want their voices to be heard.
They could go to federal court, right?
Well, but in federal court's a very different practice. First of all, the federal court would have been for our clients in Brunswick County would have been all the way in New Bern, not in their own community or an hour away, which is what they ended up doing with that case. But in federal practices, a lot of the motions are done electronically. There aren't a lot of hearings, as compared to state court. So you really don't get to participate in the process as a plaintiff the way you can in state court.
And that Senate proposal would eliminate the Human Relations Commission, right?
That's right. I mean, well, it didn't specifically say that in the line item in the budget, proposed budget, but presumably it would eliminate the Human Relations Commission.
Guy Charles, let's talk about what was happening in Texas. In other words, how the nuts and bolts of how the money was being distributed, how community groups recognized that this was discriminatory. What was going on?
Sure. So what was essentially happening was that there's a federal policy of allocating credits or economic incentives to developers, and that's administered by the state. And so what the plaintiffs were saying in that case, they were saying to the state, look, you are incentivizing those developers to build housing only in neighborhoods that are predominantly neighborhoods of color. So you're not building low-income housing in white neighborhoods. If you were doing that, that would further integration. But by continuing to build and incentivizing, providing an economic incentive in the way that you're distributing those credits to the developers, you're incentivizing them to continue to build in low-income neighborhoods, which then furthers segregation and does not further the goal of the Fair Housing Act, which is to increase integration. So that's essentially what it is that they're complaining about. And they're looking at the behavior of the state agency and saying, look at the policy that you're implementing and look at its impact that it's having on these particular neighborhoods.
And the impact, I think, showed that 92% of the housing that was being built in historically and traditionally African-American.
Right, and African neighborhoods, and the policies promoted resulted in that disparate impact.
Oh, well, fair housing cases, we said, before the Supreme Court started in Dallas, Texas. Joining us now is Alan Parnell. He's vice president of a group called Cedar Grove Institute for Sustainable Communities. He provided expert testimony for the plaintiffs during the original arguments in the Texas case. Alan, welcome to the State of Things. Good to
Thank
have you.
You
here. Also joining us is Camden Webb. He's a financial attorney and partner at Williams Mullen Law Firm in Raleigh. Camden, welcome. Good to
Thank
have you.
Thank you for
here.
Having me.
Alan, tell us about sort of your involvement in this case, and maybe you can also shed some light on how the groups there determined that there was this disparate impact.
I was one of three experts for the Plaintiffs Inclusive Communities Project. Our role, really, I worked with my partner, Ann Moss Joyner, and Ben Marsh, a professor at Bucknell University. Our job was to show the pattern that existed. And we did this first by mapping the pattern of racial segregation in Dallas. And then we located the 115 low-income tax credit housing projects in the context of the segregated city. So you could visualize, the judge could visualize the effects and the concentration in the predominantly African-American neighborhoods. We also showed that half of these units were located next to industrial sites, to give context for the effect of the segregation on the lives of the people.
The defendants must have had an answer for that. They must have been aware of where these were going. Why did they say they did it?
They didn't have an answer with me. I mean, my whole cross-examination is basically, you didn't consider this, did you? You didn't consider that. They had no answer.
So in this case, it might be a question of neglect. What about North Carolina? Do we see the same patterns in this state?
I don't know about low-income tax credit housing, but we certainly see it in other spatial forms. We see it with the drawing of boundaries of cities, the provision of infrastructure that often exclude minority neighborhoods. And so there are different ways in which the government can act to structure ongoing segregation and disparity in access to resources.
Guy Charles, in cases like that don't involve housing in particular, could advocates now point to this ruling to get relief in some of those examples?
Well, as long as those cases are having to deal with fair housing questions, so and other types of contexts, and they have to look at other federal or state statutes to provide to get relief. But as long as it has to deal with housing and under the Fair Housing Act, yes, this ruling would be beneficial to them, at least and the recognition that disparate impact is an important and vital interpretation of the Fair Housing Act.
Camden Webb, bankers have said that this ruling will have a chilling effect on them because it makes for an uncertain landscape for lending. Can you explain a little more about that?
Well, this is really one of the most important parts of the housing industry in the United States is the how do you pay for it and mortgage lending. And it's a multi-trillion-dollar industry, and everyone in the mortgage industry is looking at this. So lending is risk and managing risk and taking good risk. And when you look at the factors that go into a mortgage lending decision, they are credit risk factors. The concern with that the industry has is you have regulatory risk or legal risk injected into the equation. And that, candidly, is just much harder to gauge. You have, for example, when you have clear regulations that say you must do these seven things, that compliance equation is fairly easy. If you then inject something in there that says, well, yes, these seven things plus this that is yet undefined, you've got a level of risk in there that that's concerning. Now, what does a lender do when they see a risk they can't quantify or contend with? They usually shy away from that risk. And that's really where the chilling effect concern comes from, is the concern that having an unknown risk or an unquantifiable risk would lead lenders to frankly, make fewer loans.
That sounds like if that were true, then that's a responsibility for policymakers to make clear what the parameters are, to come up with a rubric that says this is fair housing that will not have a disparate impact. Here's how these tax credits will be applied, and you know, would that solve the problem?
Well, it clear rules are a good thing. You of course, get to a point where if you have so many rules or onerous rules that you might start shutting down credit decisions based upon that. But, yes, clear rules is a good first step. And the problem for compliance that you have with lenders, when you have a court case, court-made rules, most of the time, which is what this opinion does, the court doesn't say these are the 10 things you must do or something like that. They just say this is the result in the case. And then it's left to later decisions, either through the court system or through regulators, to clarify what the rest of that means. So there is a little interim period we're going to be dealing with where some clarity would be helpful.
Gee.
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things about this case is that the court was sensitive to this particular problem. And did say that and instructed lower courts not to interpret the Fair Housing Act in a way that would lead lenders to shy away from lending to communities of color. So it was both sensitive to the lending problem as well as the litigation problem, that the court worried that lenders might shy away because of the litigation risk, and so instructed lower courts to be very careful in how it's thinking about remedies as well as interpreting the act in order to assure that lending possibilities are still available.
Alan Pardell, your group thinks about these questions pretty deeply. Is there can this problem be solved in the policy realm? Are there places where localities or states have written rules that make it more clear for lenders?
I think in the case in Dallas, they've clarified by changing the point system they had in place to give points for where the low-income tax credit housing would be located by giving more points for building in suburban areas and lowering the points for building in highly African-American neighborhoods for concentrating and perpetuating segregation. So this is a good example of change in the process that leads to a race-blind but more equitable settlement.
Elizabeth Haddix, it does seem to be the great paradox. If you are unintentional about creating a policy, then you let the system that's in place operate under its own logic, and then the rules of risk will apply. So if we don't change the equation, if we don't change where people live, the opportunities that we give them, then the same risks will apply to that group of people in perpetuity. In other words, we have to do something to change
right.
The
I
model.
Mean, there's inertia with structural racism. That's unfortunately the way it works. But I think that I just want to say that You know, in reading all of the briefs from the financial institutions, the lending institutions in all of these cases, the Mount Holly case, the Magner case, and the ICP case, I'm not finding, my colleagues as well, are not finding any evidence or any showing of this this effect of a disparate impact method of proof. I mean, we have to remember this is a method of proof. The plaintiff bears the burden of showing, of proving that a challenged policy causes or predictably will cause a disproportionate impact. So if your statistical evidence is shown to be caused by some other factor, you lose on the first step in your prima facie case. Then the burden shifts to the defendant to show that that policy or practice is necessary to achieve a legitimate purpose of the, that the defendant has. And then the burden shifts back to the plaintiff, if the defendant carries out that burden, to show that there's another, not less discriminatory alternative that will achieve that same purpose. So there is already built into this, and always has been, a very pretty airtight structure to prevent against the harms that we're hearing from the lending institution.
What about that, Camden? If the policy had been so destructive, the banking industry or mortgage industry had the chance to demonstrate that, and clearly by the court's opinion didn't persuade the court that it would be utterly destructive to mortgage lending.
Well, now, this case didn't go into particular policies and whether one versus the other in lending was had a disparate impact, and there was no other way to do it. The problem with the system now that the lenders see is that all you have to have, and I respectfully disagree about it being, you know, tough on a plaintiff, because all you have to have is pointing to a policy and pointing to some disparate impact to have a prima facie case. Now, what does prima facie case mean? Well, that means that you get into discovery, and that means a very expensive lawsuit, and that means the defendant has to muster the evidence to say, well, for example, we did not accept FICO scores below 550, but here's the very good reason why we didn't. Okay, so it is expensive. It is something that the industry has to contend with, and bear in mind that expense in the credit industry will be passed along to the borrowers, and that's a real concern. And I point back to the change in policy by the federal regulators dating back, I believe, 18 months or 2 years ago, where they discovered the new Dodd-Frank regulations were leading to a lack of mortgages in rural areas at a certain level. I believe it was about 100 to 120,000. The lenders just stopped lending to that segment. That's concerning. When the regulations lead to folks at that income level not getting loans, that's very concerning.
Well, we saw what the lack of regulation did in 2008, so we're not going back there. But I take your point, Guy.
I think I'll have to agree with Elizabeth here. I mean, when you look at the second half of Kennedy's opinion, it really restricts the framework for plaintiffs. The burden of proof is extremely high. Kennedy requires that the plaintiffs come with statistical evidence that show causation between the policy and disparate impact, and this is at the pleading stages. So the instructions to lower courts on this particular case, I think, raises the burden of proof for plaintiffs. So even though he says that disparate impact is available, so that's a win for the liberals, but the backside of the opinion, which sort of narrows the framework and really raises the burden on the plaintiff's side, precisely, I think, as Elizabeth has articulated, I think is a win for conservatives and the lenders.
Let me ask you about this. It is usually, it had been unusual for plaintiffs, for people who felt that they were being discriminated against, to go to the courts precisely because they didn't think they were going to win. Am I right about that?
Yeah. Well, the worry about this case is that the court was not going to accept disparate impact as a method of proving discrimination. And so that would really gut an important method of proving discrimination for fair housing, and not just about fair housing, but then might have spillover effects on other civil rights statutes. So prior cases settled, and the plaintiffs settled because they were trying to keep these cases away from this current Supreme Court.
Alan Parnell, what about going forward in the state of North Carolina? Do you plan to sort of use this case as a jumping off point?
We have a range of different cases we've worked on showing different patterns. We have, you know, we work when someone comes to us with a case, and then we help provide the evidence to support the case. We don't go looking, though we have worked with policymakers to try to identify problems that might be resolved without litigation. And in some cases, we've been able to help communities address problems without litigation, which is always preferable to bring about change. So we always have our eyes open. We're always looking at the data and the policies at a local level mainly.
But this makes it more likely that you would use the courts to settle a grievance now that
we're there to help support the if there's a case being brought and we can bring evidence to support a claim, we're always willing to do what we can.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Alan Parnell, Vice President of Cedar Grove Institute for Sustainable Communities. Guy Charles is a law professor at Duke University. Elizabeth Haddix is with the UNC Center for Civil Rights, and she is an attorney. And Camden Webb is a Raleigh attorney who represents financial institutions in the North Carolina Bankers Association. Thank all of you for being on the program. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. Just ahead, a disagreement over school busing led to one of the most contentious political battles in Wake County. Find out more. Stay tuned.